So, one of the phrases that we hear a lot is the real world. And it often seems that people who refer to the real world most often and with most confidence are people who don't really have much idea what they are talking about or what that phrase might mean. So we find that people who have no real inner world have no interest in investigating their mind and are therefore restricted to a narrow band of experience, tend to be convinced that that is the real world. So in my work in education, one of the problems or obstacles that arose from the beginning was many parents would say, well, it's all very well giving children a spiritual dimension to their life. It'll make them good people and maybe peaceful adults. But would it really equip them for life in the real world? So sometimes I would ask parents, what do you think the real world is? And they would often refer to things like cutthroat competition, and this is hard truths of living in the world today. But I think that we only ever are able to experience a certain slice of life in society, and the idea that there is just one thing called society, and that it's our duty to, or it's wisest to, adapt to it and try to excel in it, is not a very sound one. I would say there are many different societies nestling within the larger society, and that we have a choice in which of these societies to associate with. But so much of our understanding of the world is based upon concepts and conventions and slogans and prepackaged ideas without any real fresh engagement with what it really means to be human being. in the present moment, or the 21st century, if you will. And as Buddhists, we feel the need to expand our understanding to include the inner world and the mind is, as the Buddha said, the source, the forerunner of all things. So how can we really understand the world we live in? How can we be sure what is the real world without coming face to face with its source, the mind? So the mind is a problem in modern science, that with all the huge sums of money that have been spent on neuroscience and research into the brain, that there is still complete blank as to what consciousness is. There are certain theories, but they're more like religious beliefs. They're not based upon any clear data. So, for instance, if you were to ask a scientist if the mind is merely the byproduct of chemicals and the nature of the brain, then in the evolution of life from the time of the Big Bang until now, at what point did consciousness arise, and how did it arise? What is the mechanism by which chemicals can give rise to consciousness? They have no answer to this. So, means there's a big hole in the whole scientific and so-called rational view of the world. Scientific theories, where do they come from? So we can enhance our senses with technology, enhance our vision so that we can explore other solar systems. We can enhance our vision so that we can penetrate to the atomic and subatomic level. We can enhance our hearing, we can enhance our sense of smell, and so on. And we can thereby increase data to an incredible amount. But in the analysis of data, in the creation of hypotheses and laws and so on and so forth, that's not there in the data. That's something that's created by the mind. So, I think it's, from my point of view, the scientific viewpoint is, of course, one of the best things that ever happened to the human race, and the advantages and the benefits of it are enormous. But it's not the complete path to understanding. It's a restricted path. It's probably taking on too much, because our life begins and ends with the subjective, And science, at least as we understand science these days, doesn't have much to say about the subjective. But it's a big step from saying that science can't really deal with the subjective to saying that therefore the subjective can be put to one side and is unnecessary to a complete understanding of life. So as Buddhist, or Buddhist scientists, if you will, Buddhist explorers, then we feel that a true understanding of life and understanding what this means, this word, the real world, what that might mean, entails an understanding of the subjective and a direct experience of the inner world. And that without that direct experience of the inner world, we're floundering and we're a sustainable world in which we can flourish for a long time to come. So meditation is a key feature of this inner exploration. And it is, I think, important every now and again just to stop and ask yourself, you know, what do you think meditation is? What's meditation for? Why do we meditate? Because the resistance that we have sometimes to meditation, the fact that we have periods of enthusiasm and periods of unenthusiasm is based upon, I think, like an unclear view of the role that it should play in our lives, and a lack of understanding of the benefits of meditation. So the coarsest kind of misunderstanding is it's a kind of magic pill that you meditate and all your troubles will go away. That's certainly not the case necessarily, and indeed with people with certain mental problems, meditation can make things worse. If in a meditation center or a monastery, someone develops some psychotic symptoms, simply go a bit strange, you don't tell them to meditate more, you tell them to stop meditating. And you get them out in the garden, do some gardening, or go to the kitchen and do some cooking, and do something for other people. So meditation, in the Buddhist sense, to really be part of the Eightfold Path and lead to liberation, to be founded on right view, right understanding. And when people meditate in order to get something, whether it's relaxation or peace, or some people want to get psychic powers and so on, then they've set themselves up on the wrong track. And meditation can actually be harmful to them rather than beneficial. Ajahn Chah would constantly remind us that we're not meditating in order to get anything. It's in order to let go of things. When I was a young monk, we had this very confident and aggressive, I would say, Christian, American Christian missionary that would sneak into, she said, just take Jesus into your heart. And I said, I've got more than enough in my heart already. I'm trying to let go of the stuff that's in there. I don't think any more would really do me any good at all. So I think this is what Ajahn Chah was encouraging for us to look what actually is going on in the heart. So it's an exploration of the heart. So there's no true peace without understanding. We can't just bypass hindrances. There's not some special technique. If you find your technique, your teacher, your technique, then your meditation will just sort of take off and you'll have no more problems. Because there is, of course, no, it's not a different mind that you encounter in meditation than the mind which is with you in every moment of day in the daily life. That is to say, if you have some abiding defilements which manifest in your daily life, then they will manifest in one form or another in your meditation. And by looking at the mind in meditation, you get some sense of what's going on in your daily life. But you also have to be working on these things in your daily life to really have the power to be able to see them and work with them in meditation. So this is kind of two-way process. But some things are so deep-seated that they really do take a long time. And so often meditators are impatient. Their time scales are wildly unrealistic. If you've been accumulating defilements for a few trillion lifetimes, you know, a morning and evening sitting for a year or two is probably not going to be sufficient to alleviate that. I'm not saying you need another trillion or trillion, trillion lifetimes of meditation, but it does take time. In the time of the Buddha, then so many of those who listened to Dhamma talk, as you know, became enlightened, or very least realized stream entry. But there are a couple of points to reflect on here. One is that to have been born at that time and that place, they must have created just an incredible amount of barami and spiritual maturity. Again, a simile that Ajahn Chah once gave is of a balloon. He said, this big balloon, and he said, well, how can just a tiny little pin pop such a big balloon? And similarly, the mind of the Savakas, the time of the Buddha, It's like these fully inflated balloons, and the teaching of the Buddha just like this tiny pinprick, and the ignorance of the mind just pop like that. But we're far away from those times, and very few people these days, one in millions, even in Buddhist countries, has that kind of spiritual maturity. It's hard work. But if we can find some joy in the work itself, in treading the path, and not be constantly looking ahead. And when am I? It's like the child in the car. Mummy, mummy, am I there yet? Am I there yet? How much farther to go? Why does it take so long? And the father looks at the, we've only gone about 10 kilometers, you know, and it's, and we're like the child. And so there is a good analogy here of the kind of attitude to practice that is most skillful, and that is of swimming. So the image is of an island in the middle of a big lake, and meditators are like people swimming towards this island. So the foolish swimmers, constantly looking up, how much further to the island, how much further to the island. So the English idiom, like a watched pot never boils, or a watched kettle never boils. So you know how the more you keep looking ahead, or as the child, are we there yet, are we there yet, you seem to go slower. Just because of that craving to get there. But that's not the only thing, because if the image of the swimmer lifting his head up to look at the island affects his swimming stroke and actually does make him swim more slowly. So the wise swimmer sets sight for the island. And then his or her emphasis is on the quality of the stroke. And then every now and again, he'll just lift his head up just to check, am I still in line with the island? And then go back to effort on the quality of the stroke. And in our practice, this is the wise attitude, that we put effort into the quality of our practice, learning to motivate ourselves in such a way that our inspiration is not conditioned by the results of each sitting that we have. Need a bigger picture. Again, in referring to analogy with education and raising children, in the old days in Thailand and in India, of course, parents would have many children. These days, have very few children in Thailand, maybe one or two children. And so the parents' love and interests and fears and anxieties are all focused just on one human being, one child. And so every little bump in their path of life is like a really big crisis for the parents. And then it's amplified by social media and talking with other worried parents. So my advice to these parents is you step back a bit. You know, it's like a river. If you're traveling by car, a river can seem to be winding this way and winding that way, and you're so close to it, you're aware of every little meander in the river. But if you go up in a plane and you're flying over that river, you can see it's more or less straight. If you're very close to it, then the wiggles and the meanders seem significant. You stand back a bit and don't seem very significant at all. And in spiritual life, this every single meditation, you know, was it a good meditation? Was it a bad meditation? Oh, I feel so low today, as really bad meditation, or I really feel good to have a good meditation. This is like the parent that's overly concerned with the single son or single daughter. So it's not that we're not assessing and learning from our experience in meditation. That is definitely part of it, reviewing experience and learning from it. But it's better to also look in terms of things of a year, 6 months or a year, to see patterns and trends developing. If you tend to be someone who likes to doubt a lot, then that too close analysis can increase the doubt a lot. Is this really the right technique for me? Am I really doing the right thing? Should I perhaps try something else? That's not an illegitimate question. It's a reasonable question, but it's not a reasonable question to be asking yourself every day. You know, give yourself a reasonable period of time, a few months, and then ask the question. So right view, like I have a brother, someone once came to see me in the monastery. He's rather rude person. You know, it's not rarely you get rude people come to monasteries in Thailand, I must say. This person was rather kind of rude. And he says, so what do you get from meditation? What's the point of it? What do you get from it? And I said, well, what do you get from going to the toilet? I said, it's not you don't go to the toilet to get something, but you feel a lot better afterwards, you know, after you've been in the toilet. I said, it's like you're learning as again, similar point with the missionary. You're learning how to abandon the unwholesome. That's the first thing that you want to do. It feels good. You feel just how unnecessarily burdened we are. The Buddha's famous simile of the poisoned arrow. I mean, life's already uncomfortable. You're just having a body. It's uncomfortable. You know, how long can you be comfortable in this body? Not very long at all. I was reading, I recommend a book recently published called The Body by Bill Bryson, who's an excellent author. And he wrote this book called The Body, An Occupant's Guide, and has some really wonderful passages and information in it. But he was talking about the spread of bugs and microbes, and they had an experiment. I don't quite understand the mechanism of this, but they insert it into somebody's nose. Just, you have to bear with me here, like an artificial snot producer. So this artificial snot producer had a chemical trace in it. And then this man went to a party, and they wanted to see this whether traces from this artificial snot that was coming from this man's nose would spread, and how far it would spread. And then after a couple of hours, this party, they did the trace, and it was everywhere. All over the furniture, all over people's clothes, and I mean, not large amounts. I mean, it's not like, you know, something that you could see with the naked eye. But the amount of times that, as human beings, just we touch our face. This is where bugs are passed through the hand. So you know, the most at home, you're going to catch a cold. The most likely place is the family computer from the keyboard. So our bodies are so naturally uncomfortable. Discomfort is the natural state of the body. That's why we're always moving here, moving there, and we're touching our face. And so little bits of snot come out. This tiny little thing, and then you touch this, and somebody else touches it, and then that. And just, so, being a human being, having a human body, it's dukkha. This is the, you know, people say, oh, that's a kind of pessimistic way to look at the world. And it's not saying life is miserable, but we're saying that there is always this sense of slight discomfort. How long can you sit completely still without having to move your body? How long before you need to go to the toilet, the bathroom, get hot? You know, the range of temperatures in the world from, what, minus 30 to 40 or 45, it's going up now, isn't it? But within that range of temperatures, as a human being, how comfortable can you be? What's the band within which you can be comfortable? What, from 10 to 30, maybe something like that. It depends on clothing, doesn't it? But if a naked human body, from temperatures from minus 30 to 40, there's not much space there to be comfortable. I was having a discussion once with a monk at a, what temperature do you think the heaven realms are? So my proposal is about 25 degrees centigrade. I think that's a heavenly temperature. But you know, you move away from 25, and you're starting to get uncomfortable already. So there is this just natural discomfort, which we have to be patient with. But the Buddha, and the Buddha refers to that as like being shot by an arrow. But because we're not aware of what's going on, and we naturally react to anything that makes us uncomfortable and want to get rid of it, the Buddha refers to the poison on the tip of the arrow. So we're constantly making bad situations worse, or making uncomfortable situations more uncomfortable than they need to be, because of this lack of awareness of what's going on in the body and mind. So now this is the real world that we live in. You know, it's not the real world of competition and making money and all those. The real world is this body and this mind. The real world is we have a body which is demanding and ungrateful. And what could be more ungrateful than your body? You think of all that you do to look after it from the day you're born. You wash it, you comb its hair, you do this, you do that. You give it food, the best food you can find, nice things to drink, you know. You do everything for your body, and it doesn't show an ounce of gratitude. All it does is it gets old, gets sick, and then it dies. I was talking to Venerable Wipassi when we first arrived, and he was talking about the Yellow Page teachings, and he says, you know, your Yellow Page teachings is things that makes things come true. You know, this is for it. And then we were talking about giving him a prediction for his life, and I said, okay, I'll give you a prediction for your life. You're going to get old, you're going to sick, you're going to die. And he said, "Thank you, Ajahn. My parents never told me that." They don't, do they? I mean, parents don't usually tell children that. But it's an important thing to know. So how do we stop making a bad or a difficult situation more difficult than it needs to be? And how can we find peace within that? It's not like finding peace away from it. You see, it's like the idea of peace is you go off into this realm. This is what people think meditation is if they don't meditated before. It's like you're living in this difficult world and you meditate and then you can just shut it all off and just go into this lovely little mental space. And so people say, oh, well, that's kind of escapist and irresponsible. And you're not sort of taking full responsibility for yourself in the world. And so people have, this is a classic we call straw man argument. It's, you know, creating this false childish idea, a naive idea of what meditation is, and then criticizing it. And so as meditators, we have to say, well, that's not really what we're doing in meditation. Well, meditation is we're developing the tools by which we can understand our experience more clearly. And if we're looking at the results of meditation in terms of ability to access these very refined mental states and just disappear into another realm, yeah, then you can feel pretty frustrated. That's not going to happen very easily. But you should be able to observe that if we're following the path of the Buddhist training and education, the Eightfold Path, you know, so you're a little bit more aware, you're a little bit more awake, you're a little bit more patient. You find this... that keeping the five precepts is not a struggle anymore. You just find it hard to imagine why you would ever break any of the precepts. This hiriyotapa, this wise, intelligent sense of shame, wise, intelligence, fear of consequences of breaking precepts become more powerful. The sense of kindness and interest and commitment to helping others. These are the kinds of things that meditators should be noticing in themselves. So if you think, oh, I've been meditating for a long time and I still, when I sit, I get sort of sometimes kind of agitated and sometimes sleepy. Yeah, that's quite possible, but that doesn't negate your effort. It doesn't mean that you're wasting your time. Look at the big picture of your life and your relationships with the people around you and the overall decline of negative mental states and the overall increase in positive mental states. This, I think, is a better way of looking at it. So you notice in terms of sensitivity, we were talking about the other day about sensitivity, in some ways you become more insensitive. And I have this image, if any of you probably don't watch cartoons anymore, but you probably did at one time in your life, or you watched them with the kids. You know, in the cartoon where the hero, somebody shoots a bullet, and the bullet just goes right through them and out the other, the sort of cartoon. And it's a bit like that when you've been meditating for a while. Somebody says something really nasty to you, or something really unpleasant happens, and you, oh, that went right through me, just like in a cartoon. And you think, wow, if somebody had said that to me or treated me like that a year ago, I would have been so hurt. I would have been so angry, I would have been, and it's not like I don't feel nothing, I just feel a little bit, but, you know, it's that's a huge change that's taken place. So there's a kind of insensitivity to the loka dhammas. So gain and loss and status and decline of status and praise and criticism and pleasure and pain, the mind is less sensitive to these things. They affect the mind much less than they used to. At the same time, you become much more sensitive to the cruelty and to goodness. So I know many meditators just find they can't watch the news anymore. It's just the crudeness and the violence and the anger it just hurts their hearts too much. So they become much more sensitive to that, and much more sensitive to goodness. And I think most meditators will. Have seen this himself. You just find goodness and kindness and generosity so moving. Sometimes you find tears in your eyes over things that are quite mundane, ordinary events. But just to recognize that goodness, because when you start to meditate and you're really at the coalface, as it were, you know, of reality, is like, how do you deal with these negative mental states? You know, even as a meditator and someone with real commitment, it's so hard to let go of this anger and jealousy and all these negative mental states. So how much harder for someone who's not even committed to reducing them, doesn't even see them as a problem? And then you see how difficult it is to cultivate wholesome and beautiful states, and how beautiful they are when they arise. And then when you see them elsewhere, it's just, oh, that's just so lovely. You know, you never realized, I think, before you meditate and you're looking within, just how beautiful generosity and kindness and altruism is. I was telling a story yesterday or day before yesterday about experience I had on this Tudong walk from Bodhgaya to Kusinara, and the fog had come down very thick. You know, you know this kind of North Indian fog, although. Not pollution fog. This is like fog in the countryside, and I walked into a town, and it was early in the morning, just before 6 o'clock, I think, and two rather well dressed elderly ladies emerged from the fog in front of me. Now, if you can imagine, I'm sure this was their daily walk. So what a surprise it must have been to them to see this big, strange-looking fellow emerge, you know. So, oh, he's wearing a robe, but he's got white-skinned, and he's big, and he's, you know, I think quite an intimidating figure, probably, you know, emerging so suddenly and unexpectedly on a route which you're very familiar. And What impressed so much and moved me so much was that one of the women, the moment that she saw me, she pointed to my head, because I'd lost my hat in a previous adventure, and I was walking bareheaded, and she just showed her shawl. And so what she was saying, obviously, was, cover your head, you're going to catch a cold. And I thought, if there's any kind of anecdotal evidence which would support the existence of altruism, you know, completely disinterested care for fellow human beings, fellow beings, then that would, I think, be my nomination. That she has nothing in it for her at all. She didn't know, and she had a right to be somewhat frightened even by it, but not at all. And how is that possible that her very first thought seeing this stranger emerging from the fog, was concerned that he might catch a cold. She's never going to see me again in her life, obviously. And so these are things, I think, when you've been meditating, then these are the things that impress you. These are the things that you remember. And your sense of what's wholesome, what's unwholesome, and what's beautiful, and what's ugly, these things evolve. And then the sensitivity, which ultimately is most important, is you become sensitive to the three characteristics of impermanence, of dukkha, and of anatta. And ultimately, if there is any like surefire, reliable indication that you're practicing in the correct way, it is that your sense and your sensitivity to these characteristics is increasing. The sense of the impermanence, the unstable, unpredictable nature of life. So not expecting things to be a certain way. You know, when people who don't meditate, something bad happens and they're like, I just had no idea. I mean, just out of the blue. I mean, who would have thought? Who would have believed? Who would have imagined? It's so unfair. You know, these are the kinds of exclamations made by people who have never thought about impermanence and how things rise according to and pass away according to causes and conditions. Now, we have how we'd like things to be and how we think they should be, but the law of karma and causes and conditions will always triumph. So we become more and more tuned into this. We have less and less expectation. We're not shocked in the same way at sudden loss or separation. But what we feel sadness, but it's not a toxic kind of sadness. It's more, you know, you cut yourself and it's going to take a time for that wound to heal up, but it's got no dirt in it. It's just a clean wound. But you think it shouldn't be like this. It shouldn't, that kind of thinking, that kind of resistance to the way things are, that starts to fade out. So one more analogy we're in is, I don't know if any of you are fans or have been fans of whodunits. You know, this like Agatha Christie and this novels and movies and things where you've got like, let's say you had 40 people in a meditation hall, and suddenly all the lights go out, and the lights come on, and there's somebody with a knife stuck out of them. You know, so who did it? So the whole fun of these kind of books is trying to work out who did it. But you know before you start that there are going to be twists, and it's not going to be who you think it is. You know, it's not going to be the obvious one. And the book is, you know, the merit of the book is often, you know, how many twists there are and how unexpected the twists there are. How unexpected the twists. You say, oh, I never saw that one coming. Oh, I thought it was him, and then he falls down a well, or he's something like this. So I think it's quite a good analogy for life. You know, it's like a whodunit. I mean, in a sense that there's going to be all these twists and unexpected twists, and you can't take anyone or anything for granted. It's And you can enjoy that. You can enjoy the twists because you don't have an idea that it must be a certain way. You just allow it to be a certain way, and you're developing the ability to be with that and to know that. And the extent to which we can be the knower, as you know, be the knowing, and in Ajahn Sumedho's phrase, means we become less demanding of life and more courageous in the sense, yeah, whatever, I'm ready. You know, I've developed the resources that will enable me to survive this and flourish and to learn from it. Okay, that maybe this morning talk can end at this point, so we just have 15 minutes for discussion or any...